Street Roots, from Street Roots.
Israel Bear.
Mm-hmm. I've had him at this moment. He's fabulous. Street Roots CEO, fantastic guy. So Luma Logica, LumaLogica.com.
Correct.
For Sarah and her work and the interviews and this new work, we will have her on the fourth Monday of August, next show. And thank you, Sherry, again so much for coming. And her book can be found all over the place. Sherry Goes Sane. Also, you can find it on my KBOO blog. And so I'll make sure all this information is on the KBOO blog as well. Thank you both for coming and gracing these mics with courage and faith and belief and wonderfulness.
I feel so blessed
to have two wonderful people like yourselves at this mic. And thank you, Kate, my board gal, for helping us. Nothing could happen without Kate in there. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
You can value them all. You really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. My name is Courtney Scott, and I'll be your host today. I am honored to have David Grimm, author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs, here with us in the studio. Welcome to Portland, David.
Thank you for having me.
David is the award-winning online journalist for Science Magazine. Citizen Canine starts back at the very beginnings of our connection with and domestication of cats and dogs, and why they, of all the animals, became our pets. But let's focus on a few other intriguing subjects from your book. One of the most intriguing sentences is when you say that due to the thousands of years that we have been domesticating our dogs and cats, we have succeeded in taking the animal out of our pet. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, what's really remarkable about our relationship, especially with these two animals. These are really, by and large, the only two animals that we've really embraced as members of the family. I mean, there's millions of animals in the world. There are dozens of domesticated animals. And yet, by and large, it's dogs and cats, especially in Western cultures and very especially in the U.S., that we've said, you know, you two animals are really going to be members of our family. More than half of all homes have a cat or a dog. And there's actually more homes with cats and dogs in the U.S. than children, than have children, which is kind of remarkable. But, you know, getting back to this idea of taking the animal out of our pet, I mean, that really kind of needed to happen for us to embrace these animals as family members. We really needed to be able to see them not as wild animals, which they're not anymore because they're domesticated, but to be able to see them as a member of the family, we have to say, you know, you have similar emotions to what I do. You think similarly to what I do. You can love me. I can love you. And this is a very hard relationship. At least the strength of this relationship is very hard for us to form with other animals and vice versa. And that's what I mean by taking the animal out of our pets, is really stopping thinking of them as animals and really starting to think of them as family members.
Right. And I think it's very interesting. Another comment you made in your book is that when people were asked, they said they'd rather be with an animal or with their dog on an island rather than another human.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stats from the book. If trapped on a desert island, this was a poll that was conducted a few years ago, trapped on a desert island, more than half of all owners would rather be stuck with their cat or their dog than with a human companion. So I don't know if that says more about where we are as a society or, you know, sort of just our relationship with our pets. But that's definitely one of my favorite stats.
That's great. I do notice that pets tend to listen really well. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, that's probably right.
So you write a lot about the importance of pets in our lives and how they have replaced children, which you just mentioned. And Portland, it turns out, is one of the friendliest pet cities and dog-friendly cities in the country. We've got, you mentioned, I think it was a dozen dog masseuses in Portland, which I didn't know that. And we now have pet taxis and fancy dog hotels. And our pets are moving from pet to people with more and more legislation, giving them protections under the law, even the right of personhood in some cases. In the process, you state that they have become saviors of our society, and they truly earn their citizenship. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, this whole legal status of cats and dogs is really fascinating because as these animals have become evolving from animals to companion animals to pets to members of the family, their legal status has also evolved. 100 years ago, cats and dogs were considered so legally worthless, they didn't even qualify as property. And what that meant is somebody could steal or kill your pet and nothing would happen to them because the law said, well, this is a useless object. You don't deserve any compensation. And then in the early 1900s, that started to change. This is an era where cats and dogs were starting to come indoors a little bit, where they're becoming more, maybe not more like family members at the time, but definitely more cherished pets. Then they did get to this property status, which is where they are today. But, you know, I talk about in this book, them sort of evolving, starting to evolve kind of beyond this property status. Even though cats and dogs are technically property, people may have heard of custody cases where couples have fought over a family pet and the judges said, you know, what's in the best interest of the dog? What home would the cat be happiest in? Which you would never do for another piece of property like a toaster. A judge would never say, you know, what home would the toaster be happiest in? And as of 2000, cats and dogs can inherit money in most states. There's even been a few cases I read about in the book where dogs have been given lawyers. So this sort of whole goes back to this idea that, you know, even though cats and dogs don't have what we would call legal personhood, no animal has that except for human beings, that they are really kind of on this sort of bleeding edge of, you know, trying, you know, maybe fuzzing this boundary a little bit between property and person.
Yeah, I would say they're gaining a lot of new rights in terms of just being considered, even to consider the fact that they might have the same rights as people. Though this is like a side subject, but have you ever read the book Dominion?
I've heard of it, but I have not read it.
I would recommend it only because he doesn't really mention rights so much as he talks about expanding our compassion towards all animals.
Right.
And I would say that has made headway. Would you agree with that in terms of, you know, people being more aware of animals needing compassion?
For sure, yeah. I mean, we're seeing some interesting polls where I believe a poll just came out last year, and I know I'm going to get this number wrong, but I believe for the first time a majority of Americans, or at least a majority of young Americans, now oppose animal research, where we're seeing a lot of uncomfortability with things like whales and dolphins in captivity. People are getting increasingly uncomfortable with factory farming. A lot of this has happened in the last couple decades. And, you know, even though it's a correlation, you know, one speculation I have in my book, well, why are we becoming much more attuned to animal welfare in this country, especially in the last couple decades? And, you know, this coincides with a period where we've really embraced cats and dogs as members of the family, where we've really started spending lots of money on them, where you start seeing doggy daycares on every corner and sometimes a kitty kindergarten or cat psychics or dog psychics or people that do acupuncture. And this all gets back to this idea that we form this very close relationship with our cats and dogs. And, you know, I think they sort of become an empathy bridge to the rest of the animal world. You know, you have this very intense relationship with your pet and you realize your pet can love and it's been a very intelligent being. And then I think a lot of people start to say, well, then why is a cow not an intelligent being? Why is that chicken on a factory farm not an intelligent being? Why is that animal in a research lab not an intelligent being? And as a journalist, I don't take a side one way or the other, but what I do think is interesting is that as we've formed a very close relationship with our pets, that seems to be translating into more of empathy and more of a sort of insight into maybe the lives of other types of animals as well.
That's a great point. I like that term empathy bridge, because that is a way, it produces a way for people to connect.
Right, right. So. I think, and especially with, kids growing up today, when they grow up in a household where the cat or dog is not just seen as a pet, but is actually seen as a family member. In many cases, these kids are viewing these pets as kind of virtual siblings in a way, because the parents are treating the pets, and we have two cats that we treat like children, even though we have our own children. So our kids are definitely growing up in a household where they're seeing, where they think they see their cats as fellow family members. And so as they grow up, they have this very close relationship with these animals. But then again, they look at other animals in the world and they go to the zoo or whatever and they go, wow, I love my cat. Why can't I have, similar feelings about this other animal that maybe it's not a pet, but, probably, thinks and lives, similarly to the way my pets do.
Yeah, very good point. I was surprised to read in your book that dogs are a lot smarter than most people, I think, would realize. I mean, there's dog cognition studies.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, I love this quote from Darwin, which is, there is no fundamental difference between man and the higher animals in their mental faculties. So just how smart are dogs? And how about cats?
Yeah.
And by the way, cats control everything.
That's
know
right.
that. So.
cats are smart enough to have domesticated us, I think.
That's right.
But it's really fascinating. In the last 15, 20 years, there's been an explosion in what's called canine cognition research. This is scientists studying the dog mind, which never really happened before. And there's about a dozen labs in the world right now that study canine intelligence. And we're learning some really fascinating things about dogs. For example, dogs can do things that chimpanzees can't do. You can point at an object and a dog will immediately know what you're pointing at and look at what you're pointing at. But chimpanzees have no idea what you mean when you point at something. So dogs are very attuned to what we're thinking, what we're trying to show them, that even animals that are much more genetically related to us aren't able to do. And that's really opened this big window into what other things are dogs capable of. And some recent studies have shown that dogs are capable of things like jealousy, of empathy, even complicated concepts like concepts of justice and morality have been shown in dogs. And I wanted to devote the book as much to cats as to dogs, but unfortunately there really hasn't been very much research on cat behavior, cat mental abilities. And that's largely because when you bring a dog into a laboratory, a dog wants to do everything. A dog will run through the maze or play the game for a treat. Cats, as any cat owner knows, and as one myself, I can attest to, they don't do very good in the scientific laboratory. So unfortunately, we just haven't learned as much about cats just by nature of them kind of being difficult test subjects.
That's to say the least. Maybe we'll have to breed a cat that's cooperative.
That's right.
No, I'm just kidding about that. No, don't do that. Okay, so right now we're going to take a short break. So stay tuned for more with David Grimm, author of Citizen Canine. Welcome back to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. David, I appreciate that you wrote about pit bulls. I think people would be surprised that they do not have locking jaws, for instance. And what else did you find out about pit bulls? As pit bulls are often the first and the most often euthanized. So how are they doing? How are they faring in the new no-kill shelters? And tell us about BSL.
Yeah, they're doing a little bit better than they were. There's this fairly dark period up until recently where a lot of states across and a lot of cities across the U.S. and Canada had very, sort of draconian breed-specific, what's called breed-specific legislation. Some call it breed discriminatory legislation, where we singled out pit bulls. Often it was mostly pit bulls, sometimes other breeds of dogs, and said, you know, these dogs are dangerous and you can't own them. Or if you do own them, you're liable for all this stuff that you're not liable for with other breeds of dogs. And living in Baltimore, you know, there was actually the Maryland's highest court had passed this judgment a couple years ago that basically called pit bulls inherently dangerous, which was sort of almost unique in the country in really sort of denigrating pit bulls with this, you know, this this status as being, you know, different than other types of dogs, that they're just more aggressive, or that, as you said, they have these locking jaws, or that they're just sort of much more likely to bite and kill than other animals. And so going into, you know, this chapter I wrote about pit bulls, I was just really interested in, you know, as a former scientist, really trying to pick apart the data. And what I really learned was, you know, a lot of these things that are said about pit bulls are not true. The vast majority of the time when these dogs attack somebody, it's really the owner's fault. This is a dog that was abused, that wasn't treated as a pet, was definitely not treated as a member of the family. And I met so many pit bulls that are just, you know, love pillows. You know, I met a pit bull that goes to elementary schools in Baltimore and helps kids with learning disabilities. These kids have trouble reading, or they have trouble learning in front of other students, and they'll bring the dog in, and the kid will have this emotional connection with the dog, and the pit bull will just sit there and basically stare very, very lovingly in their eyes. And these kids that couldn't read in front of their classmates all of a sudden are able to read. So, you know, I think there's been a lot of damage done to the reputation of these dogs that is not deserved. Pit bulls, as most pit bull owners, I'm sure, will tell you, can really make fantastic pets. So that was a really sort of nice surprise for me to discover that when reporting the book.
It'd be nice if that information were to spread, because it's still a fact, as far as I know, that they're the number one dog that's euthanized.
Yeah, you know, they say, you know, a lot of shelter people or animal welfare people will say the biggest problem in shelters is pitties and kitties. And that means a lot of pit bulls and a lot of cats, and a lot of them get euthanized. You know, we're still euthanizing more than 3 million cats and dogs in this country because people surrender them, or that people can't find homes for them. So, you know, that's something people should keep in mind. First of all, obviously, I think cats make awesome pets, but also pit bulls can really make awesome pets, and people should really consider these animals when they're looking for a pet.
I agree. And the thing is, I do want to mention, I do know that some animals are attacked by pit bulls and people, but I would say that every case that I know about, anyway, if the owner had taken more precaution and kept them on a leash or kept them safe, that would not have happened. I would say that's probably at least 99% of the time.
Yeah, for sure.
So people just, the owner would just take a little more responsibility, that would all end. Let's see. So the other thing I wanted to mention, let me go back to my notes on that. So what do you think that this new, you mentioned no kill, that this is starting to happen more and more, but yet we still have a large number of animals killed. So how much progress is this no kill movement really making, in your estimation?
I think it is making progress. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, one of the big drivers is that the public, I think, is getting increasingly uncomfortable with the large euthanasia rates we had. You know, up until a few years ago, we were euthanizing up to 20 million cats and dogs. I mean, I think that was as recent as the, you know, maybe I'm going to get this wrong probably, but I think the 70s or the 80s, you know, the kill rates in shelters were through the roof. I think as we embrace these animals more like family members, we as a public got increasingly uncomfortable with this idea that, yes, I love the dog and cat in my home, but what about those animals that are rotting away in shelters or being euthanized in shelters? So I think that really has helped feed the no-kill movement. We see in a lot of cities try to go no-kill. A lot of cities have made progress towards that. We've also seen things like in the South, and not to generalize, but in Southern shelters, there tends to be more overflow, where in places like the Northeast and probably even the Northwest, there tends not to be as much. And so there's programs that actually take these animals out of these shelters in the South and they move them to shelters in the North where they're more likely to be adopted. That reduces the kill rate in the South. Also, places like trying to take cats and dogs to malls and other places where people usually go, adopt cats and dogs from shelters. I mean, we see PetSmart and Petco do that as well, where the animals they have in the store, these are not, you know, animals from breeders. These are animals that come from shelters. And so we're seeing a lot of new distribution channels to try to get these animals out of the shelter in front of people's eyes so that they don't have to go down to their shelter necessarily to adopt these animals. And we're seeing that have a lot of success too in reducing the kill rate for shelters.
It's a tough one. Having talked to some shelter people, there seems to be a conflict between the traditional shelter and the activists who are trying to increase the no-kill movement effect, influence around the country, including here in Multnomah County. Yeah. So it's just, it's not that easy. And it's just that, you know, a lot of shelters do not take in all the animals, but the private shelters don't.
Yeah.
And I don't think many people really understand that difference, because a public shelter, they have to take in.
That's right.
And so therefore, their challenge is a little steeper. But I think it can still be done, wouldn't you say?
Right. And I think the number one thing people can do is adopt. You know, when you're looking for a pet, adopt a pet. You know, go to a shelter, find that cat or dog. Don't get too focused on breed. All cats are awesome. All dogs are awesome, with very few exceptions. You know, these are really amazing animals, and they will love you even more if you save their life from a shelter. So, you know, even though I'm a journalist and I try to be objective about most things, I am not objective about a pet adoption. I definitely think there should be more people going to shelters and adopting a lot of these really great animals.
Totally agree with you. And I'm just, you know, stunned when I think I read a statistic that only 30% of the people who do get animals adopt.
Yeah, I think that's different now. I'm not
Is
sure what
changed?
The stats. Yeah, I think there's a lot more adoptions happening. I think it actually may be over 50% now. And when, you know, the funny thing is, when you used to ask somebody about their pet, especially if it was a dog, they'd say, you know, 23 years ago, they'd say, oh, well, you know, this is a such and such breed, and here are his papers, you know, and I got him from this, you know. And now what's one of the first things somebody will tell you if you ask about their pet? They'll say, oh, he's a rescue. I got her from the shelter, right? And it's so nice to be able to see that's, and you see all these billboards, you know, even big pet food companies really getting behind adoption. It's just really, I think we're really seeing a sea change in adoption really being seen as the way to go to get these animals.
That's great. So the other thing is, there are, just in case people don't know, there are breed-specific rescues.
Right.
If anyone wants a golden retriever, there are golden retriever rescues, and I imagine there's pit bull rescues and, Chihuahua rescues.
If you want a specific breed of dog, you can still, by and large, get those animals from rescues, so you don't have to buy them necessarily from breeders. In fact, even for cats, one of my friends they really wanted a Maine Coon, and so they went to a Maine Coon rescue. So, you know, it's for cats and dogs.
Wow, I used to have a Maine Coon, but mine just came from somebody's basement. But he was still a great cat. Okay, so, you know, my favorite topic in your book is about how animals are so therapeutic. Mm. I think this is, like, just an amazing benefit that, you know, really makes them special in our lives. Pit bulls are great, many other dogs and cats. There's even a popular llama right here in Portland called Rojo, and he goes and works with autistic children.
Oh, that's great.
So, and I personally met a therapy donkey.
Well, you know, it's great because, you know, we sort of, when we first domesticated cats and dogs, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, they were very much working animals. They weren't really pets. You know, they did stuff for us. Cats, you know, hunted mice and rats and protected our grain supplies. Dogs helped us hunt and herd. But in the last few decades, and well, maybe probably even longer than that, cats and dogs are really kind of, you know, they've been frisbee catchers and lap sitters. They've kind of been on permanent vacation. So if they get a bad rap, it's that they don't really do anything anymore. They just kind of like sit there and they're fed and we play with them and they just like sort of live the life of Riley. But that's why I love writing about service animals, because there are still a segment of these animals that perform very important functions to society. Therapy animals, therapy dogs. I talked about the autism and learning disabilities. Cats, you know, I profile a couple that takes cats to old age homes, and people that have Alzheimer's that are really kind of checked out. You know, they'll bring the cat in. These people all of a sudden start to reconnect with reality, and they'll start remembering their family members and even the pets that they've had. So these animals, and studies have shown that, you know, cats and dogs can decrease blood pressure and anxiety. So, you know, even though these animals kind of sort of have a reputation of not doing a lot for us anymore, they actually do quite a fair amount.
And so that's part of your statement when you say they earn their citizenship too.
Exactly. I mean, they're earning their keep in terms of their positive impact on our physical and our mental health. And also the idea that we've become very isolated as a society. You know, we live, you know, divorce rates are up. People live by themselves much more than ever before. We live in much smaller family units than we ever did. We're in a very virtual society now where everything we seem to do is on the internet, even friending people and talking to people. It's all texting and Twitter and Facebook, or we all go out to a cafe and we with a group of friends and we all stare at our phones the whole time. So, you know, cats and dogs have become, in some ways, the sort of the last physical, living, loving presence in our lives. You know, your dog is not going to go in the other room and play Xbox. Your cat's not going to text message on his phone instead of listening to you. And so that's what I'm talking about, that for them sort of being the saviors of society, because sometimes it feels like our society is kind of becoming much more isolated and much more fractured. But then we look at our pets that are saying like, hey, there's still stuff happening in the physical world. I need you to walk me. I want you to pet me. I want to cuddle with you that you're not going to get from the internet. So, I think in that way, they still are performing very important functions in our homes.
Let's just never teach them to text.
That's right.
Okay, you know, I love the story in your book about the 90-year-old woman who was actually afraid of cats. And then you brought this person, I forget their name, but I think it was a couple.
Yeah.
And they brought in this cat. And tell us about that, her reaction.
Yeah, this was the couple that I profiled in New Jersey. And basically, they take cats to VA hospitals, to old age homes. And these are, people, again, who are very sort of, they have Alzheimer's or they just have dementia. And it's very hard to communicate. Even the nurses have a very hard time communicating with them. They give them medication. The medication doesn't do anything. But I had this nurse tell me at this home that I went to with this couple, they said, she's like, I haven't seen anything have the kind of impact that cats have when we bring the cats in. And these cats are very mellow cats that this couple brings in. But yeah, there was this old woman there. She was very shy. And she said, could I please have some time with the cat? And she just sat down. They put the cat on her lap. The cat just sat there and stared into her eyes. And she basically started crying. She was so touched and moved by the experience. I love seeing stuff like that. Because again, cats and dogs have a bit of a bad rap for not doing anything anymore. And then you see something like this and you realize how important these animals can be in our lives beyond just, sitting on pillows and going for walks with us. We can really have these really strong emotional and physical reactions to them.
In my view, the pets are therapy for everybody. Yeah. Even if you're not an old person in a home or, you need them for some kind of psychological therapy, they serve that purpose for everybody. Also, you talk about Mark Beekhoff and his work with prisoners.
Yeah.
And I found that very interesting, too. I just saw a story about wild horses, that they're using prisoners to tame these wild horses.
Yeah.
And that's connecting them the same way people connect with pets. So tell us a little bit about this prison situation.
Yeah, I never thought I'd end up in jail, but I actually ended up in jail for this book. Mark Beekhoff is a cognitive ethologist. He lives in Boulder, Colorado. And, he teaches this prison program once a week where he goes to a prison and he talks to the inmates about animals, about animals having emotions. And when I was there with him, we talked about dogs and cats. What's really interesting about dogs and cats is a lot of these people that end up in prison grow up in very broken homes where they're abused, they're mistreated, and sometimes their only friends growing up were their pets. And so even though these people may have killed people and they've gotten into fights, they have this very strong relationship with cats and dogs because these are the friends they grew up with. So that was really interesting to see.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And it helps to save the animals too.
For sure.
So I'm just going to read a little bit from your summation and have you comment. I thought it was a really interesting summation in your book here. As much as pets have civilized us, however, I think they've also kept us wild. Of all the roles they play, the most important may be that of shaman. Instead of bridging the gap between our world and the spirit world, they serve as mediators between our asphalt jungle and the real one. We need them to remind us of who we are and where we came from. When we turn cats and dogs into people, we lose the animal part of ourselves. Is that something we're prepared to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of my book really talks about how we've turned cats and dogs into people, both like family members in our home, but also, as we were talking about earlier, something sometimes like people in the eyes of the law. But I think what's also great about cats and dogs is, we have so little contact with other animals in our lives anymore. Most of us live in these big cities where we don't see horses and we don't see cows and we don't see chickens. Well, maybe see a little bit more of that in Portland, but in other cities, you don't see that much of that. And so animals are so divorced from our lives that one of the great things about cats and dogs is as much as we've domesticated them and as much as we've turned them into family members, they're still animals and they still have animal instincts and animal behaviors. And, sometimes that's annoying and frustrating and causes problems. But, I like to look at the positive part of that, too, that like this is sometimes, this is often the last bridge that we have. We used to be animals. We were out, in the wild, and our cats and dogs somehow, I think, also let us reconnect with our wild past to remind us that it's not just, the world's not just about people, that there are animals in the world, and that is a very important part of who we are that they remind us about.
Excellent. Thank you, David Grimm, for sharing your well-researched and fascinating book, Citizen Canine. Stay tuned for more great programming on KBOO Portland. Tune in to Voices for the Animals on the fourth Monday of every month at 11:30 a.m. or catch the podcast of this program online at KBOO FM. The music heard on today's program is by Gaia and performed by Martin Wilkinson on cello and Sharita on the cajon.
Everybody, I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Monday, July 27th, 2015. In local news, a new report by Bloomberg News shows that rent prices in Portland have seen one of the biggest increases in the country over the last year. Rent prices have increased at an average of 15% since this time last year. At the same time, home ownership levels have fallen since 2008, increasing the demand for rentals. This has pushed Portland's vacancy rate for rentals to among the lowest in the country. Despite the high rent, it's become extremely hard to find an opening, according to the new report. The director of the Oregon Department of Human Services has resigned from her position. This makes her the third agency head to be replaced since John Kitzhaber resigned as governor last February. Aaron Kelly Seal was named to the position heading the state's largest agency in 2011. Kelly Seal will remain on the job until a replacement is sworn in. In other Oregon news, presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders may be denied a spot on Oregon's primary ballot despite running as a Democrat.